Yasodhanandana Vrajanarandana Yamuna Tera Vanachari Yamuna Tera
Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada Ki Jai Kantraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Gaur Gaurandi All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories, all glories. Shri Guru, Shri Gauranga, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo,
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. Reading from Canto 1, Chapter 11, Text 24. Raja Margam Gate Krishne.
Raja Margam Gate Krishne.
Dharakaya Kulastriya.
Dharakaya Kulastriya.
Hamyanya Ruhur. Hamyanya Ruhur Vipra. Tad ikshana mahotsava Rajamargam gate Krishne Dharakaya kulastriya Harmanya ruhu vipra Tad ikshana mahotsava Rajamargam gate Krishne Dharakaya kulastriya Harmanyaru vipra Tadikshana mahotsava
Rajamargam gate
Krishne
Harakaya Kulastriya karmanya virhu vipra tadikshana mahotsavaha Ajamagam Gate Krishna Narakaya Kulastya Harmanyaru Vipra Tadikshana Mahotsavaha Ajamagam Gate Krishna Varkaya Kudastriya Translation by Srila Prabhupada. When Lord Krishna passed over the public roads, all the ladies from the respectable families of Dwarka went up to the roofs of their palaces just to have a look at the Lord. They considered this to be the greatest festival. Purport. To have a look at the Lord is a great festive occasion, undoubtedly, as it was considered by the metropolitan ladies of Dwarka. This is still followed by the devout ladies of India. Especially during the days of the Julan and Janmashtami ceremonies, the ladies of India still throng up in the greatest number at the temple of the Lord, where his transcendental eternal form is worshipped. The transcendental form of the Lord installed in a temple is not different from the Lord personally. Such a form of the Lord is called Archa Vigraha, or Archa Incarnation, and is expanded by the Lord by his internal potency just to facilitate the devotional service of his innumerable devotees who are in the material world. The material senses cannot perceive the spiritual nature of the Lord, and therefore the Lord accepts the Archa Vigraha, which is apparently made of material elements like earth, wood, and stone. But actually there is no material contamination. The Lord being Kaivalya, one alone, there is no matter in him. He is one without a second, and therefore the Almighty Lord can appear in any form without being contaminated by the material conception. Therefore, festivities in the temple of the Lord, as held generally, are like festivals performed during the manifestive days of the Lord of Dwarka, about 5,000 years ago. The authorized acharyas, who know the science perfectly, install such temples of the Lord under regulative principles just to offer facilities to the common man. But persons who are less intelligent, without being conversant with the science, mistake this great attempt to be idol worship and poke their nose into that to which they have no access. Therefore, the ladies are men who observe festivals in the temples of the Lord just to have a look at the transcendental form are 1,000 times more glorious than those who are non-believers in the transcendental form of the Lord. It appears from the verse that the inhabitants of Dwarka were all owners of big palaces. This indicates the prosperity of the city. The ladies got up on the roofs just to have a look at the procession and the Lord. The ladies did not mix with the crowd on the street, and thus their respectability was perfectly observed. There was no artificial equality with the men. Female respectability is preserved more elegantly by keeping the woman separate from the man. The sexes should not mix unrestrictedly. When Lord Krishna passed over the public roads, all the ladies from the respectable families of Dwarka went up to the roofs of their palaces just to have a look at the Lord. They considered this to be the greatest festival. Om Gyanananjana Shakya Chakshu Dhammina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah. So I read through the previous chapter and this chapter and the next chapter to fully appreciate the context and the story that's being described here. And it struck me how we have two pastimes side by side that have a very deep philosophical import. The previous chapter was Krishna leaving Hastinapur, and this chapter is Krishna entering Dwarka. And the leaving Hastinapur was very, I don't know if you recall, but the mood was very sad. It was very intense, the separation, the anticipation of the separation, and just that experience was very heartbreaking, actually, when you read the description of that scene. And it wasn't just a few people, it was the entire city of Hastinapur was just drowning in an ocean of lamentation and misery of that separation. And at the same time, we know, and we've heard in our different pastimes how it's said quite often that when there is a separation or a leaving or a departure, it's important for whoever's doing the send-off to have a smile on their face, because it invokes suspiciousness in that separation. So just imagine the pain of that separation between Krishna and the residents of Hastinapur, and then trying to put a smile on their face at the same time. Just imagine how difficult that must have been. And then now, Krishna is entering Dwarka, and that's the polar opposite experience, where Krishna is entering Dwarka, and the entire city is, all of the citizens, all of the inhabitants of Dwarka, not 99%, but 100%, of all the inhabitants of Dwarka were fixated 100% on the arrival of Lord Krishna. It was undeviating, uninterrupted, constant, unmotivated darshan of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. And I really appreciated how Krishna so elegantly and so gracefully received all of them. This incredible reception of the Lord. I was reading Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary yesterday or the weekend, and it was describing all of these different personalities and their duties. Their sole duties were to welcome Krishna. I don't remember the Sanskrit terms, but there's one group, one profession, and all they do is chant the lineage of the king or the leader. That's all they do. They chant the glories of the lineage. And then there's another whole set of individuals. Their whole job in life is to praise the glories of the King. That's all they do. It's not like they have other jobs. That's all they do. And like that. And then there's other personalities. And then they have the Gandharvas, right? All they do is sing. They sing. So when Krishna's coming in, you have all these personalities. And then you have the Natakas, you have the actors. All they do is act. So they enact all, you know, pastimes, stories in remembrance of the Lord. And you have dancers. So you have all of these professions, and their whole purpose in life is to create this warm welcome for the King. And what to speak of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Shri Krishna. So it's incredibly beautiful description that's given there, and just trying to visualize and experience that through the eyes of the citizens and inhabitants of Dvaraka is very pleasing to the heart if we can immerse ourselves in this pastime. I was just thinking yesterday how amongst philosophers and religious thinkers, it's commonly thought of that philosophy is higher than stories, right? Like, we all over India, Bhagavad Gita is actually, I would say, the most popular. The Bhagavatam is popular amongst the Vaishnavas, but Bhagavad Gita is universally popular. Everyone knows the Bhagavad Gita. Everyone has heard verses, memorized verses, is aware of it. But the Bhagavatam, only a select group of the citizens of India they may have heard it, but are conversant and actually have heard of the stories in the Bhagavatam. So I was meditating how that the Bhagavatam actually illustrates and makes the point to those who are in tune with the truth that the lila, the pastimes of the Lord and His devotees, is actually the highest philosophy. Right? They may be like, if you read these stories from a mundane point of view, oh, they're just stories, some guy come here. But even on a philosophical level, the lila that's being described in the pages of the Bhagavatam encapsulates and represents the highest possible philosophy known to man. And that is because of the ontology of love. Gorchan, can you describe to us what the ontology of love is?
Krishna desired to experience love, and therefore he expanded himself into Krishna and Radha. And out of his own choice, he puts love as higher than him. And you can also say that if you want something and it's not under your control, that something is greater than you in this sense. So, love is greater than Krishna by Krishna's own will.
Thank you. That was beautiful. So I'll just repeat in case you didn't hear. Essentially, without love, or without the desire for prema or bhakti, there's really no purpose for differentiation or variety. Is that not correct? In other words, what Gaurachand was speaking about is the ontology of love, that there would be no reason for Krishna to expand himself as Radha and Krishna if love wasn't a coveted Then there would be no purpose for Krishna to expand himself as Radharani. But Krishna wanted to love. But you can't love yourself. Correct? Love means you have the object of your love. So, this lila, these pastimes, is simply the expression and exchange of love. And the whole reason why any of us are here, and the whole reason why the whole material and spiritual universes were ever created, and all the varieties of life, and forms and qualities, names and planets and experiences, is because Krishna wanted to taste love. Therefore, bhakti is the absolute highest philosophy, absolute highest absolute truth that exists. Therefore, this philosophy of rasa, our relationship, is the highest philosophy. Of course, Bhagavad Gita is full of rasa and relationship between Krishna and Arjuna, but the emphasis is on the philosophy. But here we're actually reading the lila, the pastimes of the Lord and his devotees. So in this purport, Srila Prabhupada, he makes some very important and significant points that we should all reflect upon, because they have deep spiritual and philosophical significance. After reading this pastime and reading Prabhupada's purports, it reminded me of one of the teachings of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that who emphasized this philosophical concept of drig drishya vichar, which is the seer and the seen, the drashta and the drishya. And our acharyas explained how, and especially this was one of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's major contributions to the philosophy of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and especially to eradicate, pursuing the mission of his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, eradicate the upper sampradayas, the deviant Vaishnava traditions, like the Sahaja class, is that the on an external appearance level, the Sahajas appear to be Vaishnavas. But internally, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he said the way to differentiate the hypocrites from the sincere and the genuine practitioners of Vaishnavism is the internal application and full understanding of this concept of Drigdashi Vichara, which is the natural expression of bhakti within the heart, where when you love someone, it is natural that you see the world through their lens. So, and our acharyas actually make this really powerful point that if we perfectly practice Krishna consciousness, then all the assembled devotees, the only priority, the only thing that is of utmost importance in our lives will be, what is Krishna experiencing? What is he seeing? What is he hearing? What is he smelling? What is he tasting? What is he doing? Everything else is insubstantial and irrelevant. Just like in the mundane world, if we understand when two individuals love each other, you're constantly thinking about, is he okay? Does he have enough to eat? Is he clean? Does he have everything he needs or she needs? You're constantly, in that same way, Drigdashi Vichara means it means taking oneself out of the center and putting Krishna in the center. Now, acharyas make this very powerful point that if we properly practice this principle of the seer and the seen, there will be no envy amongst this society of devotees. Which makes complete sense, because if you think about it, if everyone is thinking about what is Krishna seeing, what is Krishna experiencing, if we all think about that, then it doesn't really matter how much I'm doing, how much you're doing, or how little I'm doing and how little you're doing, or what I am and who I am, right? Doesn't that make sense? If we all just see the world through Krishna's eyes, then there will be no envy. I thought that was so powerful, that point that our acharyas make. There's a few pastimes in the biography of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur where he illustrates within his own life how he, in a previous class, I believe I mentioned it, but because it's such an important philosophical point, I feel inspired to share some of the stories again for those who haven't heard them. But they're just very short anecdotal stories that illustrate, you know, how dear that this be passed down to the next generation of devotees and in the society of devotees. But the most famous pastime, I think, that I think many of you have heard is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was at the very back of the temple room and he was taking darshan of the deities, and one of his disciples approached him and said, are you able to see the deities? You don't have your glasses, you know, because he wore glasses. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, essentially, I don't remember the exact words, so I'm not doing it justice, but essentially what he said is, it doesn't really matter what we see. It's we present ourselves before the Lord so that we can be seen by the Lord. Our whole goal in life is to be seen by the Lord. Not that we, and he makes the point, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur makes the point that as soon as we, if we think that we are seeing Krishna, so all we're really doing is eye exercises. He says, the image of Krishna's form is bouncing off of our retina. This is his exact words. It's like, it has nothing to do with bhakti. The form of the Lord bouncing off of our retina is nothing to do with bhakti. That is the material brain trying to see something and trying to experience something. No. Bhakti is how, what are we doing with our life? How are we pleasing the Lord? How are we being seen by the Lord? How are we being enjoyed by the Lord? It's not about us enjoying, it's us being enjoyed, us being seen, us being pleasing. We are the object of Krishna's enjoyment. And on another occasion, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was standing behind Garuda, the Garuda Stampa in Jagannath Temple. And he said, our hope in life is, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, for millions of lifetimes, our hope is that by standing behind Garuda and Krishna casting his glance on Garuda, there's a slight possibility that the glance may go a little bit to the right and Krishna will notice us. Beautiful, huh? So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj is just standing behind the Garuda Stampa. And then, again, the eye exercises. There was a group of pilgrims that were attending Bhagavatam class. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was actually giving the Bhagavatam class. And when the aarti started, they all got up and they left the lecture. I think later on, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj remarked, they have left to go for eye exercises. He said, the way to see is through the ears. We first need to hear. And then through hearing, can we actually see? I was thinking about how, why this activity of glorifying is so important to devotees. And in glorification is actually one of the most integral components, aspects, and characteristics of bhakti itself, of love. This outpouring of glorifying, of praising, eulogizing, exalting the object of our love is such an important activity in this process of Krishna consciousness. And I was meditating how the difference between the mundane experience of enjoyment versus the spiritual experience of true enjoyment. So from a mundane perspective, the object of our quote-unquote love may be an ice cream cone. And so we eat it. We enjoy it. Whereas and you may praise it, you may glorify it or appreciate it, but it's very external. It's a very superficial kind of experience. As with any form of sense gratification, it doesn't touch the soul. It's very superficial. It's on the external. It's on the outside. It doesn't touch the soul. But when we're glorifying Krishna, when we're glorifying his devotees, it's such an entirely different, philosophically, different activity. Because the expression of the heart is that I am incomplete without you. And when you glorify the object of your glorification, the object of your love, it's almost as it's a call to become united
with the object of your love, that glorification. So you're glorifying the Lord, you're glorifying the Lord, you're glorifying the Lord, you're thinking about the Lord, you're thinking about the Lord, you're glorifying the Lord, you're glorifying the Lord. Because without the Lord, we are empty. We're not complete. We're not whole. So you're glorifying, and the object of your glorification, you become like the object of your glorification. You're uniting with the object of your glorification. So it's not just a sensual thing where you're smelling something, eating something. No, bhakti is more than that. It's not just seeing Krishna or hearing Krishna or taste. It's uniting with Krishna. It's becoming whole again. It's joining, it's rejoining Krishna in the spiritual world so that we can actually be whole. We can be ourselves. Like without Krishna, complete, but not, I'm trying to think of the word. But we're not
satisfied.
Yeah, satisfied also, definitely. But so that's that's why glorification is and if you think the difference between lust and love, like I know my Guru Maharaj in his lectures say if you want to, he gave two examples. He said if there's a call to 911 and there's domestic violence, the police officers are actually shaking in fear because they don't know what can happen. But if there's a 911 call because of a drug deal, they're like, whatever. And they take out their guns and whatever. And they get out, get on the floor, show me, handcuff you, whatever. But when they enter a scene of domestic violence, it's like when there's like that friction, there's no telling what could happen. It can turn crazy. And the divorce courts are the worst courts. The friction in the divorce courts is more than the murder courts and homicide courts. And part of the reason is because it's not love. It's lust. And when we actually experience love, we're glorifying, right? You're wanting to be like that person. Like Prabhupada always say, when you glorify the Lord in your process, you become godly. You actually become like the object of your love. Because of the Lord, not because of ourselves, but because of the Lord. Actually, in one of the purports in this chapter, Prabhupada says something very amazing. He says, when the devotees glorify the Lord, they themselves are glorified. Prabhupada says that in this chapter, in one of the purports. He says, when the assembled devotees, they glorify the Lord, they themselves are glorified. And why is that? Because Krishna enters their hearts, makes them whole, makes them complete again. What greater glorification is there than that? So when we glorify the Lord, no, we don't give. We receive. So, in the purport, Prabhupada talks about the Archavigraha, which is apparently made of material elements like earth, wood, and stone. But actually, there is no material contamination. For the Lord, he says somewhere in the purport, he says, for the Lord, everything is spiritual. So this actually reminds me that Gorchan and Kunja and I, we read the Chaitanya Charitamrita together on the weekends. And this was reminding me of what we were discussing during the Chaitanya Charitamrita reading was how the differentiation or the differences that we see in the same object is due to our awareness, is due to our perspective depends on our realization. So for Krishna, from Krishna's viewpoint, everything is spiritual. There is no material. So what does that mean? That means material exists for those who want to see something as separate from Krishna. So if I want to see something separate from Krishna, then Krishna says, okay. If you want to see something separate from me, here's the material world. But for me, I don't see you separate from me. So for me, everything is spiritual. So the difference is in our awareness and how we approach the Lord. And that can be expanded to so many different principles. But we were discussing how we have Satchidananda, Sat, Sandhini, Chit, Samvit, and Ananda is Ladini Shakti. And Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami in the Chaitanya Charitamrita makes this point. Gives the example that this verse in the Bhagavatam, Vadanti tat tattva vidas tattvam yajnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdate. That this Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan is not like apples, oranges, and watermelons. No, they're not three different things. They're the same thing. It is because of our chit. It's our awareness that they appear differently. If you want to see the Lord as the impersonal, all-pervading, formless energy and effulgence that permeates all of existence with no variety or form, our existences even, then Krishna reciprocates, yes. I am that chit, I am that sambit, I am the awareness of Kaivalya, the Brahma Jyoti. If any yogi wants mystic power, or if he wants to realize the Lord in the heart, then Krishna, he reveals himself as Paramatma. And there are some yogis who meditate for 200 years in a cave, and just aware of the Paramatma within their heart. And for those who want to experience rasa with the Lord, then Krishna appears as Bhagavan, Swayam Rupa, Sri Krishna, Shyamasundar, Govinda. But it's not that the Brahma Jyoti, the Paramatma, and Bhagavan are three separate people, are three separate things. Just like we were discussing, remember Kunja? About the mountain. What's, can you give me a mountain? Explain the mountain analogy we were discussing.
When you're far away from the mountain, it looks like a small little, like not very big.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're close up to it, it looks like pretty big. You can see some details. But then when you're on top of it, you can see like everything on it and all the trees and stuff.
Excellent.
So it's just it's still the same mountain, but you can see it in like different ways.
Very good. It's not like there's three different mountains, right? It's the same mountain. But depending on where you are in relation to the mountain, it appears differently. In the same way. Dhamma paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabdate. The same thing. Name, form, qualities, and pastimes. It's all the same. But the pastimes are different depending on how we approach Krishna. So maybe there's a few things, more things we could talk about, but I kind of feel like I've talked too much, and I would like to open it up for discussion. Anyone would like to make additional thoughts or questions? Bhuvan?
Thank you, Prabhuji. It was really very beautiful class. Mm-hmm. I love that. I have one comment and one question. Comment first. On your philosophy versus Bhagavatam, and I always think about that similarly, and I can relate that all our, you know, algorithms in science and mathematical equations and, you know, all our equations and all that, it's kind of a philosophy. It's a dry philosophy. It's good for scientists, but a common man cannot understand those equations, and probably it doesn't matter to him. But the real implementation of those sciences is when you are in a spaceship, or when you are in an aeroplane, or even when you are using a smartphone. Mm-hmm. That's a real implementation, and a common man loves that. So that's a comment that, you know, for a common man, Bhagavatam is the implementation of that philosophy. He may not like that dry philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, but when it comes to the Bhagavatam, he loves the story. That's a real implementation.
Thank you.
And once, if he loves that stories, if he cares for Krishna and gets into it, that means he got it. He really doesn't need to learn all that algorithm, mathematical equations and everything. He had the real implementation, which is a real smartphone.
Thank you, Prabhu. Yeah, we were actually, Kunja, you remember we were discussing in Bhagavatam class how they were, when the sages of Namishranya were praising Suta Goswami, they said that you're experts in the science of Krishna consciousness, except some portions of the Vedas. They say that, remember? And those portions is what, like what you're saying, all of these mathematical, you know, all these intricate verses and rituals. And Suta Goswami, he's not, they even said that. They said, even though you're not experts in all portions of the Vedas. So even Suta Goswami, he wasn't proclaiming to be expert in all the rituals, all the detailed sacrifices and procedures and pronunciations and meters. So thank you. That's a very good point. That Gaurachand was explaining the ontology of love, it really boils down to that. Why is anything here in the first place? Krishna wanted to experience love. That's it. That's the end of story. That is the summum bonum of all philosophy. Because from the very beginning of time, the very beginning of existence, Krishna says, I don't want to be alone. I want to separate myself so that I can experience loving exchanges.
And that's where my next question is actually, on love. So, and you mentioned see and to be seen by Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
And that equates to love, or to be loved by Krishna. So we know that Krishna loves all of us, but we are all working to love Krishna. And so how does it compare? So my question is how to develop that love.
Mm-hmm.
That's a conclusion. By all these stories, yeah, we know how we try to experience us. Okay, every moment how Krishna is seeing us, you know, he cannot only see from outside, he can even see us from inside. So he is watching us all the time. But how does it boil down to the result that if I want to develop love for Krishna, how do I do that?
Very good question. It's actually the most important question we can ever ask, is how do we love Krishna? And I understand your question. Practically, what does that mean? And we were talking about this during a satsanga at some point. We were talking about forgiveness. And forgiveness is not pointing a finger at someone, saying that you did this to me, it's your fault. You know, you you made a mistake. That's not what forgiveness is about. Because you can forgive someone, but in reality, that person never did anything wrong. Right? Never did anything wrong. But you can still forgive them. So what does forgiveness mean? Forgiveness means letting go. Right? Somebody can do something, somebody can become, like get 100% in the math test, and you get mad at that person, because I want to get 100%, I want him to be the top grade, not you. The person who got 100%, he didn't do anything, he just got 100%. But you need to forgive him, because you still need to forgive him, because you need to let go of that attachment that you had of you wanting to be the top student in the class. So forgive is about letting go. So we were discussing, Gorchan Kuncha, you might remember, we were discussing how the intensity of love is proportionate to the amount of sacrifice we make. You remember discussing that, Kuncha? So love, what does love mean? To that extent we're willing to let go, is to that extent we're able to love Krishna. Let go. And you can see also, even in the spiritual world, we were discussing in our Chaitanya Charitamrita class, even in the spiritual world, in Dwarka, one neighborhood in Goloka, the queens of Dwarka are married to Krishna for a reason. They're married to Krishna because they're not willing to let go of their chastity. The gopis in Vrindavan are willing to let go even their chastity for Krishna. And therefore, they are engaging in parakīya rasa, unwedded love, which is the highest form of maha-maha-bhava, of Krishna prema. So, to answer your question, we can cultivate love by our willingness and our practice of giving up what is near and dear to us. If we are attached to any of the six vices, lust, anger, to that extent we're willing to give up anger, to give up lust, to give up greed, to give up envy, to that degree we can cultivate love. Because really, Krishna prema is inherent in the heart of every living being. It is not something that is not extraneous. It is already there. It's literally a matter of letting go. And as soon as we let go, our intrinsic nature to love and to be loved will be manifest. Does that answer your question?
Thank you, Prabhuji. Yeah, that's very good. Basically what you said is, love is already there, we don't need to develop it, we just have to remove all the covers on top of it. Love will automatically come
out. And actually Krishna will remove it. Evanukampatam hammagyana jamtamaha. Krishna says he will remove the darkness, the ignorance within our heart. What is our job? Right? We need to let go. So we let go of the six anarthas, right? And then Krishna will come and take it away. But if we're grabbing on to something, and we're having a tug of war with Krishna. Krishna's not going to force us. But we have to let go. As soon as we let go, it says, oh, okay, I'll take it. So it's all about letting go.
Thank you.
But Krishna is the purifier. We don't do anything. We're not the doers. Does anyone else? Okay, I'll read this question from a text message. It says, question, some psychologists say, this is from Ragatmika Mataji, some psychologists say that one must love themselves before they can love others. Can you comment? Wonderful question. That's so beautiful. So, really, when psychologists say love yourself, According to Saint Francis of Assisi, he says our inability to love someone is because, again, we're holding on to something. And a lot of times we hold on to shame. We hold on to guilt, shame. These are very detrimental to our healthy constitutional position. Because the message that we're communicating is that, Krishna, I am too fallen for you to purify me. That's what you're saying. Right? Krishna, I'm too... Your mercy is not that great. Your compassion is not that great. Your ability to purify is not that great because I'm so terrible, I'm so bad that nobody can purify me. Right? That's what shame is. That's what guilt is. It's an unhealthy guilt, I should say. Unhealthy guilt. But if we let go of the shame, that no matter what we did, like Jagai and Madhai, they performed so many sinful activities we can't even imagine. Killing cows, killing brahmanas, raping. I mean, what you did in your life can't even compare to a single drop of the sinful activities that Jagai and Madhai performed. Yet, Lord Chaitanya delivered them. He gave his mercy, completely purified them, made them into his own associates. So, when we love ourselves, what that essentially means is we let go of shame, we let go of guilt, and as Saint Francis of Assisi said, we stand naked before the Lord with all our vices, with all our virtues, all of our good, all of our bad. We don't hide behind the bad, we don't hide behind the good. We stand naked before the Lord. And Krishna will make us into what He wants to make us. And Jiva Goswami in Bhaktisiddhanta says the same thing. He calls it Samukhya. That the only possible activity a living entity can ever perform is to face the Lord and not hide behind our false ego, not hide behind our intelligence, hide behind our mind, hide behind our gross material body. But to basically stand naked and not hide behind any of these coverings and let Krishna's sun rays just purify ourselves to the core and become who He wants us to become. Samukhya. So this is, but you know, but if from a philosophical point of view, according to my Guru Maharaj, you can't love yourself. Love is meant for the object of your love. Just like you can't love Brahman, my Guru Maharaj always says, you can't love an impersonal God. You have to love a personal God. But the, loving yourself, what that means is letting go of all of this dirty garbage that's holding us back from communion with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We want to have communion. Right? Sambhog. What is, how do you say? Union? Pradagovindapru? How do you say union? Samyog. There's a union and separation. Separation is the Vipralamba. And then? Yeah. So it's not that union, right? Vipralamba and union. We want to let go so that we can reunite with Krishna.
So on that one, I just wanted to ask one more if you have time.
Yeah, maybe. Does anyone else have a question? But I think this could be the last question. Sorry? What is it?
There are some comments.
Okay. Okay. You probably go into. You wanna? Do we have time to do one more question? Okay, why don't you ask your question and then we can read the comments and then we can end at that, after that.
Just quick, on the reciprocation side. So, you know, if there's a girl, you know, comparing that with the material object, the love part. You know, if there's a girl, we want to love love her, or there's a, you know, man, woman wants to love him. Unless there's a reciprocation on the other side, it's not really a love. You know, you are thinking, okay, yeah, I love her or I love him.
Mm-hmm.
But unless there's a reciprocation, there's not a love. Similarly, you know, unless there's a reciprocation from the Krishna, we may think, yeah, I love Krishna. But unless there's a reciprocation, it's not really, you know, called a love. You know, it could be, you know, some my mental speculation or something. So, is there really an existence of reciprocation from Krishna? That is,
well, I mean, the fact that we live here is reciprocation. Right? When we had told Krishna, we don't want to live with you, we want to live separate from you. He says, oh, no problem. He creates the whole material universe, all the planets, all the rivers, all the mountains, all the living entities, all the plants, giving us shelter, giving us these bodies, giving us a mind, false ego, all this variety, all this enjoyment, all of our senses. He's giving this whole world. He could have just put us in the closet, blindfolded. Here, live. You don't want to be with me? Here, live in a closet, blindfolded, live in darkness for the rest of eternity. You were saying something? So, but Krishna doesn't do that. He created the whole material cosmos with so much variety just for us. Think about it. Look at that reciprocation. And we're the criminals. We're the offenders. We rejected Krishna, our own father. And Krishna's so loving. He gives us beautiful creation that we can live separately from him. What more reciprocation is there than that? This is like amazing. Krishna's love is amazing.
There are a couple of comments.
Okay.
So I like Krishna's activities. Explain. Karasa says I like Krishna's activities. Explain. Leaving and arriving, the emotional experience for those present, beautiful explanation made me think how we are able. And she said also, to experience all of this as well by the grace of Srila Prabhupada, who brought the Srila Bhagavatam into our lives, thank you for better insight into seeing through the eyes of Guru or seeing through the eyes of Scripture.
Thank you, Kunja. And who is the commenter? Who?
Mahavishnupriya.
Mataji ki jai. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Samavita Bhaktavinda ki jai. Gaur Prabhanande. Hari Hari Bo.
There's something called ontology. You know what ontology means?
No.